Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is Joseph G, and I'm a refugee from... Hello, my name is Joseph G, and I'm a refugee from several 12-step programs and co-creator of RumRadio.org. RumRadio.org was created to inform, inspire, and empower sponsorship locally and internationally to be the very best, both personally and spiritually. A sponsor is someone who takes you through the 12 steps. A sponsor is a guide, a mentor, a friend, and a teacher. A sponsor is the older brother and sister we never had. There are many 12-step programs. Overeaters Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, Debtors Anonymous, and on and on Anonymous. There's even a Paranoids Anonymous. The only problem, no one will tell you where they hold the meetings. As people in recovery, we have learned that addiction is a spiritual malady requiring a spiritual solution. We are not weak people trying to get strong, nor are we bad people trying to get good. We are sick people trying to get well. Rum Radio is for anyone that thinks they might have a problem with excessive compulsive behavior that manifests itself in addiction. RumRadio.org addresses the A&A model, but can be easily conformed to any adverse spiritual malady that manifests itself into addictive behavior. The particular spiritual malady is but a symptom of the disease. At RumRadio.org, we get down to causes and conditions. We in recovery have discovered that the one assurance of getting happy, joyous, and free was to work with someone who suffers from the same malady. But you can't give away something you don't have. Rum Radio is that resource, and like usual, if you find a benefit, pass it on. Take what you need and leave the rest. I have dedicated my time, talents, and treasure to this end. The credit for this work is God's and the fellowship. This is Joseph G. See you on the radio. RumRadio.org.
Hi, this is Joseph G. and Harold B. You there, Harold?
Yes, I am. Good evening, everybody.
Good to have you with us, Harold.
Thank you.
You're really a benefit. You're welcome. You're really a benefit to this effort. Your knowledge and expertise is really important to a lot of people. Tonight's show is Barriers to Recovery. I'm just returning back from the Spirit of Houston Conference. Matter of fact, 9:02, that means they've just finished the 9 o'clock meeting, and the dance starts at 9:30. So that's where the pretty girls will be. But some of us have work to do. It's a fun work, but work's still the same.
Let's thank our sponsors.
Oh, our sponsors. You mean the guys that sponsor us?
Well, the people
I'm sorry. I don't know where my mind is. Oliver, I wanted to welcome you in. Oliver's joining us from the Half Measures Room tonight.
Hey, how's it going tonight, Joseph?
Good, Oliver. Thank you so much for joining us. Oliver is going to, we're going to put together, Harold, I don't know if I told you, we're going to put together a sobriety network of radio shows under one banner. And there'll be Rum Radio, Half Measures Room, Sober Couch, and there might be a couple more down the road. So hopefully the thought is every night there'll be a show that people can log into. Some nights you're not going to be able to, and this way we can share some of our expertise in different areas and promote recovery and sobriety. Isn't that a great idea?
That's a great idea. I'm really glad to hear that that's happening and things are expanding. There'll be something every night.
And Oliver is one of the key players in that. And I know Oliver quite a while. I was there when Oliver walked in the rooms at Hope Group in Cedar Park. And how many years ago was that? 10 years ago? Around 10, I would think.
I think it's been more than 10 years, but yeah, around that time.
More than 10. Wow. Where did the decade go? I turned around and it was gone. I want to thank WNAH in Nashville, Hoyt Carter. He sent us out over live radio in Nashville. Nashville, parts of Tennessee and Arkansas. Want to thank WNAH. They do this as a service to their listeners because they appreciate their listeners and their sponsors and believe that this is a good information for the community they serve. Also wanted to thank Recovery Today magazine. You can get to it, recoverytoday.net. Recovery Today is running one of the articles for rumradio.org. If Bill was the sail, Dr. Bob was the anchor. And Recovery Today will be working with us, trying to expand our ability to reach more and more people in recovery and beyond, people who are still suffering and do not know that there is hope and a solution to their addiction. But you have to take each step. I've just read in the scripture somewhere, if we take a step towards God, He'll take a step towards us. So here's giving you the idea where and how to take that step. Again, that's recoverytoday.net. You can order it hard copy, or it's free online. So Greg L. At the he's the editor there, and it's a great magazine, great information. I believe you can't have too much good information. Okay. I wanted to do, tonight we're going to do recovery, barriers to recovery. There are certain signs in recovery. I'll start with this, and you guys tell me your feeling on it. I'm going to read a section of it, and then give me your strength and hope, particular areas to your understanding. First of all, the newcomer is life's blood to AA or to any 12-step program. The new person coming in, life's blood. Just like the old-timer is the backbone, the person who has gone through this and prevailed and been able to stay away from the addiction and is able to get back. That's the old-timer and has accumulated years and experience. But relapse is the soul. For there's nothing more tormented than a head full of AA and a belly full of booze. And it happens more often than I think we'd like to think that it does happen. And I wanted to go over tonight some of the obvious symptoms of what happens just prior that I found to relapse in the rooms. Sobriety will take care of drinking. Recovery will take care of the problems that caused you to drink. Relapse is best sensed by the nose, as the language of the body can be easily overblown. So sometimes that's why the importance of a sponsor being right there. Your sponsor can see it happen, and you can smell the alcohol. I mean, you can see what's going on right in front of your eyes. Body language is so strong that sometimes what you say I can't hear you because your body language is so loud. The following is a checklist of symptoms leading to relapse, any of which could be barriers to recovery. If the symptoms are caught early enough and recognized, the alcoholic will usually try to change his thinking to get back on his program again. A weekly inventory of symptoms might prevent some relapses. The first one is exhaustion. And the thinking that I came up with, there is time enough to rest in the grave. Allowing yourself to become overly tired or in poor health. Some alcoholics are prone to work addictions. Perhaps they are in a hurry to make up for lost time. Some of us lost a lot of money while we were drinking and drugging. Houses, businesses, wives, etc. We're in a hurry. I've got to get it back now. Good health and enough rest are important. If you feel good, you are more apt to think well. Feel poor, and your thinking is apt to deteriorate. feel bad enough, and you might begin thinking a drink couldn't make it any worse. Gentlemen, what do you think?
Well, that's my experience. There were years and years of messing up and doing the wrong thing and making poor decisions and being just unreasonable to people that I lived with. And then I got clean and sober for a couple of months and thought, well, that takes care of that. Everything should be back to normal. All the relationships should be healed. In fact, they should be grateful. My first sponsor compared it to wanting applause for running out of a burning building. You know, I was doing things that everyone does all the time, but I wanted all this applause and all these accolades for that. It takes time for us to dig our way out of the hole that we dug ourselves into. I mean, climb our way out of the hole that we dug. In fact, the first step is to stop digging. But and along the way, the lack of sleep has really been a big problem. A lot of these are linked. One near the bottom of the list here is omnipotence and thinking I can do anything I set my mind to. That's what my mother taught me, but it really doesn't apply. We do have to get our rest. Even God rested on the seventh day.
Absolutely, which is tomorrow. And how about you, Oliver? How you doing with exhaustion and relapse? What have you discovered?
I definitely relate to that symptom. I remember this time around when I first got sober, I just was emotionally vacant, and I was always tired, and I just didn't have the motivation, the energy to really do much except go to meetings and meet with my sponsor, which I was doing on a regular basis. And then I faced a crisis at about 2 months sobriety where I didn't know where I was going to live. I was facing losing my family, losing my wife, and I was no longer living in my home. I was pretty much living out of a suitcase in between my folks' house and my grandmother's house. And things just didn't seem to be getting a whole lot better. You know, I remember sitting in these meetings, you know, and people talking about how wonderful their lives had become now that they've worked through the 12 steps and they've stayed sober for a time. And in my case, it seemed like things were getting worse. You know, I didn't think these people were giving me enough time to recuperate. And that really, I stood there at the jumping off place that the big book talks about, you know, that turning point. It was either, you know, accept the spiritual solution, you know, accept the help, or go back to drinking. You know, those are the two choices that I faced at that point. And thank God that I decided to work through these steps as hard and as quickly as I could. That was the advice my sponsor gave me. You know, he told me that when things get really hard in sobriety, that's what we do. We double up. We increase our efforts. We redouble our efforts. You know, so that's what I did. And he told me. I remember when I was just exhausted from the emotional distress I was going through, the obsession, not only to drink, but the obsession to have my wife back, you know, to have my family back, for everything to return normal. These are the obsessions that were really, really plaguing me at that point. You know, my sponsor told me, look, if you don't get through this stuff, you know, you're going to drink. You know, that's been your history. You know, you've been in and out of AA, you know, he told me, he's like, if you're tired, Oliver, go to sleep. If you're hungry, eat something. If you're lonely, go to the group, be with some people. You know, just real simple, common sense type stuff. And that's what I did. So yeah, exhaustion is definitely a red flag that pops up in my life. That's, you know, that's one of my my defects of character. You know, when I get depressed, when I get exhausted, I just stop doing things. And that's what we come into the program. A lot of people come into the program with. They got this self-loathing, this this self-centered, you know, the poor me, the self-pity, and that's all the really negative, counteractive stuff. And it's really hard to deal with. And that's how we would deal with it, you know, when we were drinking. You know, if we felt bad about ourselves or we were exhausted, we drank. You know, so. Yeah, that's really the only two alternatives we have as alcoholics, you know, either accept a spiritual solution, you know, start working the steps, start doing the stuff that AA members do, or drink again. You know, that's it. That's our choices.
Thank you.
That's right. Hey, and something Oliver said reminded me of my first sponsor who, in addition to HALT, Hungry, Angry, Lonely, Tired, he had a great sense of humor, and he added an S, which is seriousness, taking myself too seriously, the inability to laugh at myself, and because one of my major problems was self-pity, that really helped me a lot to take a look at myself, laugh at myself, and not take it so darn seriously. That really helped with my self-pity problem because I didn't want to drink.
Thank you, Harold. I wrote this on the website. When you're digging out of a hole, enough is a little less than too much. Dishonesty. Yeah. Our lips begin to moonlight lies and half-truths. This begins with a pattern of unnecessary little lies and deceits with fellow workers, friends, and family. Then come important lies to yourself. This is called rationalizing, making excuses for not doing what you do not want to do, or for doing what you know you should not do.
Yes, that there's so much about this topic in the Bible. And what a big problem our big mouths get us into. I could go on forever about this one. And it really, a good friend said that what he had to do to take care of this in his own situation is to stop himself in mid-sentence if he was beginning to exaggerate or round the sharp corners of the truth. In a conversation, he would stop himself and say, well, excuse me, I misspoke there. What I should have said is this, and then correct himself immediately. You know, a good dose of step 10 really helped him, and he helped me by sharing that.
I had an experience, somebody there in Austin. John Kay, I don't know if you remember him, Oliver. He's a Christian writer, and he's written, I don't know, 24 Christian books, long-term member of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to make sure I didn't break anybody's anonymity there just for a second. But anyway, he shared in a meeting one time that he had a problem with telling little white lies, little lies to bolster himself. And I thought, gee, when I heard that in the meeting, I go, like, this guy is well known in the community. He's, you know, he's a solid Christian and well thought of. Why would someone like that even have the thought of trying to little white lies to bolster his ego? And if you know the program, this is the way we are sometimes. And the only way he was able to break that habit was that when he lied, and I gave you a little taste of that just earlier, Harold, when he lied, he would immediately turn around to you and tell you that he just lied to you.
Yes.
Let me tell you, that's a hard thing to do. It's okay if you're kidding around. Like I said, I had a premeditated lie, which I was kidding around with you. But I did that. There was a lady that was interested in me at a church function. She said she emailed me, and I got her email, but I wasn't interested in a relationship with her. So she said, "Did you get my email?" And I said, "Oh, no." I said, "Yeah, you know, the electronics." And, you know, a lie always takes a third leg, if not more, to keep it standing up. You always got to put a couple little braces under a lie to keep it standing. And, oh, you know, electronics, and, you know, it might have got lost in the nebulae, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then finally I just stopped and I said, "No, I'm lying to you. I got your email." And she had the strangest look when she looked at me. It was hard to get it out, but when I did, I felt empowered. You know, that it was able to overcome that. And like a switch went off. And, you know, like most people, when you get a new toy, you want to use it again. And that evening I was talking to my brother, and I told my brother, I was in the conversation, I says, "No, I'm lying to you." And it didn't miss a beat. He knew that I always was lying to him. It was no news to him. Anyway, what's your experience with that, Oliver, with dishonesty?
Dishonesty was a way of life. You know, lies seem to feed on themselves. I really, in some ways, I really didn't know how to be honest with somebody. You know, I remember the very first time I was actually honest with myself and another person. Unfortunately, it was with these police investigators that had just arrested me. And it had finally occurred to me that that's what had placed me there in that police station was the drugs and the alcohol. And it just came pouring out of me, you know, this brutal honesty. You know, unfortunately, it was, you know, I was,
you were putting yourself in a position to be harmed. You were confirming your crime.
Yes, yes. You know, I mean, sometimes, you know, it is better to be quiet rather than to, you know, but, you know, honesty is one of the first things that I learned to do in AA, you know, was if I was going to be honest with somebody, you know, it had to be my sponsor. You know, it was only going to hurt me if I didn't tell him the truth. You know, and there's all kinds of ways to be dishonest. You're talking about exaggerations. You know, I mean, I'm living in the state of Texas that's known for tall tales and exaggerating, and that's something real common with me. You know, even today is really stretching the truth. That's a very hard thing to go back, you know, and on your word. You know, like you were saying, you know, "Oh no, I was lying about that." You know, but that's very important, because like I said, the lies just seem to manifest themselves, you know, just out of one lie. You know, you got to keep telling them to cover up, you know, when I was drinking and using, it was kind of hard to keep inventory of all these lies I was telling people. And it just got so bad, people just didn't trust me anymore. Didn't trust anything I had to say. And that's one of the, it's one of the gifts that I have today. You know, people actually take my word as it is, and believe me, and that's a wonderful thing. That's a beautiful thing to have that trait back, you know, that quality. You know, I was thinking today, or yesterday, I went to a meeting, and there the topic was, you know, what do you have today? What do you do today that you didn't do when you were drinking? And I shared in the meeting, and I said, I think the most fundamental thing that's changed in my life since I've stopped drinking is my perception has changed. You know, the way I look at the world, the way I look at my life, that's been the most fundamental change, is the way I perceive everything and my perception. Honesty, I mean, that's one of the fundamentals of being sober. You know, we got to stay honest, open-minded, and willing. You know, those are the three things that we learn or relearn to do, you know, once we come into the program.
Thank you. That's probably one of the keys to long-term sobriety is honest. You know, if you can be honest, no matter what your mental state, and I'm talking about whether you're schizophrenic or bipolar or have even mental disorders. I've seen people with these disorders and worse get well from the disease of alcoholism if they have the capacity to be honest.
That's true.
The problem is, when,
in the program, we call it rigorously honest.
Yeah.
And it takes, that's a whole other dimension, very, very difficult for me in early recovery. One of the parts of honesty that really is important to build trust is being able to make clear agreements and keep agreements. Being honest in that way, showing up on time, being where we say we will be, things like that. Accountability and responsibility fit in there under that one big umbrella. It's a risk to be honest, because one of the things we need to be honest about, one of the things I need to be honest about, is what I really want. And if I put that out there in an honest way, I may not get it. Other people might turn away. And so I'm opening myself to be hurt. I think that's one of the things that I had to come to grips with in early recovery, is that there will be some times when if I'm honest about what I want, I may not get it, and I have to learn to deal with that without chemicals, without alcohol.
On that note, one thing I think it's important to remember, especially with the newcomer, with the new sponsee, we're not used to being honest, most of us, when we first come into the rooms, and it's a process. So sometimes you have to be a little bit more patient as the new sponsee learns what it means to be honest and gets into that habit and breaks the old habit of lying, and lying even when the truth would have served us better. It's such a habit, it almost seems congenital, which means that they're genetically predisposed.
I think
right,
it is congenital.
You think it is?
I think it is. Our basic nature.
The next one would be impatience. You ever heard this? Patience is bitter, but its fruits are sweet, right? Patience is too bitter for my taste. Things are not happening fast enough, or others are not doing what they should or what you want them to do.
That relates to my early recovery, when I shared that after several weeks of being clean and sober, I thought everything should be fixed and everyone should have forgiven me completely.
Yeah, really. Right now. How about you, Oliver? Were you impatient when you first got sober?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the patience thing, you know, like I already mentioned, you know, I kept hearing, you know, all these people in meetings and seeing people's lives change, and mine I just wasn't getting that. It was getting worse, and even though I was going through the work, you know, I just what I understood, and what, you know, listening to my sponsor, you know, God bless my sponsor, he talks about God a lot when we talk to each other, and he told me that I have to live life on God's terms. You know, sometimes, you know, my higher power doesn't always give me things when I want them. You know, he gives me things when I'm ready for them, and yeah, that's something that I had to realize. You know, I would ask for these things, you know, I would ask, you know, God to you know, remove this you know, this pain I was going through, or to remove this anger, or to give me you know, allow me to trust somebody or forgive somebody, and it just wasn't happening. And you know, and he told me, you know, sometimes, Oliver, when we ask God for something, sometimes the answer is no, but there's always a good reason for it, you know. But I really like the part of the big book, you know, it says that more will be revealed, you know, if we truly seek, you know, our God's will for us, you know, more will be revealed to us as we continue that work. So yeah, things, you know, I didn't think things were working fast enough for me, but when I really concentrated on what I was supposed to be doing at any given moment of time, and that's one of my favorite prayers still today, and in sobriety, it was something I used a lot, is, you know, God, remove this anger, remove this fear, remove this obsession and direct my attention to what you would have me be. And at that moment in time, it could have been driving down the road, you know, or it could have been doing something at work, or it could have been listening in a meeting, you know. That's one of the things I had a hard, I, you know, still to this day, I sometimes have a hard time concentrating in the meeting, you know, because my thoughts are elsewhere. So yeah, patience is something, it's a virtue that it takes time to develop. And I think we really start to slow down once we start getting through this process. I think things really start slowing down for us, and we start staying in the moment instead of, you know, living in the past or living in the future.
The other would be, the next one would be amenitiveness. I have put this down. The eye of a gnat on the head of a pin. I have to be right and I have to win. Arguing small and ridiculous points of view indicates a need to always be right. Why don't you be reasonable and agree with me? Looking for an excuse to drink.
Yes, I really owe a lot to my first sponsor, who said that one of the most valuable things is to determine that you will learn something from every person you contact. And as long as I was arguing, I wasn't learning anything. But when I took a moment to listen, really listen carefully to people, listen so intensely that I could repeat what they were saying, I had half a chance of learning something. And there are times to argue, but it's I just needed to learn. I felt like I was one of the people that got one of the lifeboats on the Titanic. I was so grateful to be there, and so I did a lot of listening. You know what your sponsor says, take the plugs out of your ears and put them in your mouth.
Yeah, and how? The next would be, argument is tough sometimes. You know, when you get really short, what I found is sometimes instead of dealing with the stuff that's going on in my life, I have to be right. I've noticed it with road rage is similar to that. I think road rage is a form of argumentative. It's a sense of control. Where people have no control in their lives, somehow they're going to take control through the argument with a car. There's 4,000 pounds of steel and glass, and I'm going to be right. I'm going to have that right away, even if it's only for a nanosecond, even though I'm jeopardizing my life and your life, but I'm going to have this control over this. And so I don't have to deal with what's really going on with me.
For me, it was always going to teach that guy a lesson. So when my assignment became learn something from this, instead of teaching that guy a lesson, my assignment became listen and learn something. Shut up.
Good. Depression. I've come across this depression, anger with no enthusiasm. Unreasonable and unaccountable despair may occur in cycles and should be dealt with and talked about.
Talking is so valuable. And the ironic thing is that it usually depression occurs at a time when we really don't feel like talking. But if there's someone that can sort of force us to talk, that's a healthy thing.
And I think that's where the sponsor comes in. You know, this is really for the sponsor to look at some of these situations and to be aware of what's going on. Let's see, where I go. Self-pity, a sinkhole with a lavish banquet of despair. Why did these things happen to me, for me? Why must I be an alcoholic? Nobody appreciates all I'm doing for them. Poor me, poor me, pour me another drink of alcohol.
Yep, I minored in depression. I majored in self-pity when my drinking days, and I really got good at this. We had regular pity parties, and I would sit on the pity pot. It was miserable, but I was really good at it. I didn't want to give it up. You know, step six says, became entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. And I thought, why wouldn't I be entirely ready automatically? I mean, why is this in there? Why is that step there? Why wouldn't a person be willing and ready, entirely ready, to give up depression and self-pity and resentment and on and on and on? And the answer dawned on me one day very, very vividly. I wasn't finished using that defect. I was still having pity parties. I'm not ready to give that up if I'm having a regular pity party on a weekly basis. So there was the answer to my question. I'm not entirely ready if I'm still using it. So I had to stop using some things. Well, what I did was replace that with other things, and further down your list is gratitude, and that's what I used to replace the self-pity. Just look around and see, two things, gratitude and helping others. That is the only way I finally got some relief from this constant self-pity.
How about you, Oliver? Did you run into that at all?
Oh, definitely. Self-pity, depression, being argumentative, these were all things that I dealt with in early sobriety. And, you know, there are times today where I fall into a blue period. And I think, you know, not only is it important to talk to a sponsor about these problems, and, you know, like you said, I understand it's you know, when you're depressed, when you're feeling sorry for yourself, it's probably one of the hardest times to talk to somebody. But I mean, we not only need to talk to our sponsors, but I found it's also helpful to have other people in the program. There's other guys that I trust. There's guys in my Steel on Steel group that I talked to, three guys that I trust, you know, with my life and my, you know, my personal things. But there's a couple other guys besides my sponsor and my Steel on Steel group that help walk me through some things. You know, my sponsor's not always available. You know, he works with other guys. He's got a job. He's got a wife. You know, he's got a life. You know, not to say he wouldn't pick up the phone if I called, but you know, there's a whole fellowship out there, and I didn't really understand what the fellowship was. I thought the fellowship, you know, in previous periods of sobriety was going out to, you know, bowling with people from the group, or going to the group for the dance, you know, or having that, you know, that cook-off on Labor Day, or you know, going on these golfing tournaments. The fellowship for me was the people at my group that were in the program that had gone through similar things that I've been going through, and were able to stay sober. And those were the people that I talked to, and they either A, told me things that they did that did not work, that were the wrong things to do, or they would tell me that the things that they did, they were the right thing to do, and help them to stay sober. So just talking to people made me feel better. You know, just, you know, even if it was just whining to somebody, and I'm very careful not to do that in meetings. You know, when I'm in a meeting, I think it's important to share the message. It's not my personal group therapy session. You know, I take that stuff to my sponsor or the other guys that I trust. And Joseph, this is a great show. I really love these topics, but I really have to go. But thanks for having me on. And
oh, you're welcome. Thank you for dropping by. You've been a big help. Thank you so much, Oliver.
Nice right, talking with you, Oliver.
Yes, likewise.
Good night.
That's an excellent point that he shared, that the meetings are not a therapy session. It's not our personal time to go on and on about personal stories, but instead the meetings that I get the most out of are where we talk about the solution, we go over the steps, and we stay in the solution without war stories, without a bunch of personal whining.
Yeah, it's a personal problem I have with that. I don't know what the term is, you know, when something really bothers you, the little dealy. We're supposed to share in a general way what happened, what it's like now, what happened, how it was, what happened.
Yeah, what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now.
Right, in a general way. When I hear people saying specific names and incidences, and it's very emotional, it's like, so, you know, group therapy and a self-help dealy going on, it sounds like group therapy, that's not what was. You're supposed to tell the specifics to your sponsor. And then the meetings, we share in a general way, and even what, and we connect up what we did, connected with working the step that got us out of that dilemma, or how we solved the problem using a particular step. That's the way it was really supposed to be, but it's turned, a lot of times it turns into this, you know, the crybaby deal, you know. I don't know. Don't get me started on that. It drives me, you know, like I love and tolerance is our code, you know, and that's why it's our code. We have to tolerate, you know, not everybody's on the same level of recovery, and you just have to accept that. I think the important thing is for the sponsors to make it aware to their sponsees. And everybody's supposed to have a sponsor. Everybody. It's like
that's
an American
right.
Express card. You don't leave home without one. If I hear somebody says, well, I don't really have a sponsor, but I'm going to sponsor somebody, I tell them, you're not supposed to sponsor somebody unless you have a sponsor. You're supposed to be working the steps in order to help someone else work the steps. If you're not working the steps, you shouldn't be working with somebody. Well, how come you don't have a sponsor? There's no accountability. So you're just freewheeling it. You're staying sober, going to the meetings. I throw out a two-minute blurb like that, and I'm getting my spiritual bump, but I'm good to go. And so this is where these really come into play, the relapses, is because they're really not working the program. They think they are. I mean, the next one would be cockiness. It's my favorite. That's enough about me. Would someone else like to talk about me?
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
No longer fear of alcoholism going into drinking situations to prove to others that you have no problem. No problem. No, this often enough and will wear down your defenses. The saying in the program goes, if you hang around the barbershop long enough, you will get a haircut.
That's right, and I call this one overconfidence, and it almost got me at the five-year mark. The enemy voice, the voice of the disease of alcoholism, hangs in there, is very, very patient, and in my situation, at the five-year mark, the voice was saying, look at you, you've got 60 months. 60 months of total abstinence. You are cool. You have arrived. And in fact, you should celebrate. And what better way to celebrate than to take a drink? Or if not celebrate, you should test it out. You should try just one. I'm sure you can handle it. Trust me. The enemy voice goes on. And then the second step is the enemy voice says, look at you, you're great, you're basically cured, so you can relax, you can put up your feet, you can coast for a while, you don't need so many meetings, you don't need to talk to your sponsor, you don't need to work the steps. And that's the way the enemy gets in and gets a foothold so that eventually we can be drinking more than we ever drank before. Overconfidence is what I called it. and only the people in the rooms who came and got me and who called me on the phone said, "Where are you, Harold?" That pulled me back to reality. But it's easy to get cocky.
Well, talking about getting cocky, I forgot to give the call-in number.
Oh!
Oh, well. Yeah, 949-534-0621. 949-534-0621. I know you figure we're having a great time, but we'd have a better time with you. We have about a little less than 15 minutes, so we're going to have to double up a little bit here and see if we can get through the, I believe, the 16 signs of relapse. The next one would be complacency. Smug as a bug and oblivious to the fly swatter snap. Complacent. Drinking was the farthest thing from my mind. Not drinking was no longer a conscious thought either. It is dangerous to let up on disciplines because everything is going well. Always to have a little fear is a good thing. More relapses occur when things are going well than otherwise.
Yes, totally failing at something and being down in the dumps was a problem for me, but a bigger problem was when everything went well and I had extra money and things seemed to be going great. My spiritual condition was affected, and I kind of figured in the back of my mind that I really didn't need God that much. I was doing pretty well on my own, and that's very dangerous for me.
Next one is expecting too much from others. Now I am a sheep, but all they can see is the old wolf's clothing. I've changed. Why hasn't everyone else? It's a plus if they do, but if it's still your problem. If they don't, they may not trust you yet. May still be looking for further proof. You cannot expect others to change their lifestyles just because you have.
I figured that because I learned something, everyone in the universe has learned it also. I don't know where that comes from, but that's, I've talked to other people who feel the same way. It's amazing. You were saying last week that you met someone not too long ago who had never heard of AA.
Yes.
Once I learned about AA, I thought everybody knew about it. But sometimes we have to go back to square one and explain things from the beginning.
Letting up on disciplines. If you're bored, you're boring. Prayer, meditation, daily inventory, AA attendance. These can stem from complacency or boredom. You cannot afford to be bored with your program. The cost of relapse is always too great.
You can say that again.
I almost did. If you're bored, you're boring. You got to keep your program fresh and alive. Sometimes that means changing sponsors, changing groups, expanding your experience and your religious affiliation. Personally, I believe AA, and Bill W. said it too, AA is spiritual kindergarten. You can't get a PhD in kindergarten, and if you do, it just means it's piled higher and deeper. We're supposed to expand that spiritual experience beyond the rooms. And if you're doing that, if you're going out and you're being of maximum service in the rooms and outside the rooms, you won't be bored.
Yes,
but it takes effort.
I thought to myself, as far as expanding my spiritual growth, I began to think, as it says in the book, what are these millions of people getting from, for example, from their study of the Holy Bible? And so I secretly snuck off to a corner and began to read it and study it. And you know the rest of the story. When one does that, the Bible comes alive. It's a living, breathing item. And
it really
blessed me. It really, really,
right.
And it continues to. I got hooked. I got hooked right away.
Expand your horizons. The road narrows, but the view broadens. Broaden your view. Take the actions. Step out of your comfort zone. You can't be growing spiritually and be comfortable at the same time.
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned that. Being uncomfortable for the right reasons was one of the biggest gifts my sponsor gave me. When I was drinking, it was all about being comfortable. And stopping was very uncomfortable. But some of the repercussions of heavy drinking were way more uncomfortable. So I had to learn to be uncomfortable for the right reasons. And something Dr. Scott Peck teaches, and he taught in his book, The Road Less Traveled, is to welcome the strange and the different.
I really got a
lot out of that. And that was a great part, a great boost to my recovery also. Welcome the strange and different. How do you like that?
I very much so. 12, use of mood-altering chemicals. One makes you larger and one pill makes you small. Go ask Alice when she starts to fall. You may feel the need to ease things with a pill, and your doctor might go along with you. You may never have had a problem with chemicals other than alcohol before, but you can easily lose sobriety. Starting this way is about the most subtle way to have a relapse. Remember, you will be cheating. The reverse of this is true for drug-dependent persons who start to drink.
Boy, that's a powerful paragraph. That is really key. Even over-the-counter medications can lead to other problems. It's very, very wise advice in this paragraph. And the drug addicts who start to drink thinking, well, alcohol was never a problem for me.
no problem. yeah, problem. I know I have a buddy of mine who had the 8 years he did the marijuana maintenance program because it doesn't say anything in the big book about abstinence from marijuana. So he figured as long, of course he's deceiving himself, because he couldn't really quit marijuana, but he wasn't drinking, and he was getting his chips and talking in the meetings and all that, and finally he came clean, but it took him 8 years.
Wow. Marijuana is not harmless.
No, I know. People think it is. It's a tremendous deceivement. It's a gateway drug. People don't want to hear it. It's just like alcohol, blah, 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 blah. It's really sad that some counties and states are going along with that thinking. We don't fight against flesh and blood, but principalities and dominions and wickedness in high places. That it will have no good effect by encouraging people to become semi-anesthetized.
That's right.
You want to put them on ice? Is that the deal? Is that why the government's doing it? They want to put you on ice. What's the deal? That you want to live life? Do you want to live in a false reality? Is that the best you can do? All right.
Almost every week I talk to somebody who tells me, insisting that they drive better when they're high on pot.
They're deceived. Denial is not just a river in Egypt. They can't think of not doing anything without being stoned or high. And the prospect of that is puts them into a state of fear.
And they really think that, and they believe what they think. People believe what
they believe that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they reinforce that fact. over and over again to justify their behavior. But they don't want to – it's a fantasy world, and they prefer not the reality, because reality to them is painful. But you got to remember, pain being human, pain is mandatory, but suffering is optional. And if you think by smoking a doobie you're going to miss that suffering, you're just putting it off for a later date. And it's going to – and it'll pile up. It's karmic law. It'll come and bite you in your butt when you least expect it, and the bite is pretty ferocious. We diverse. We better get moving on here. Wanting too much. It's not that we want too much. It's that too much has happened. Do not set goals you cannot reach with normal effort. Do not expect too much. It's always great things you were not expecting happen. You will get what you were entitled to as long as you do your best, but maybe not as soon as you think you should. Happiness is not having what you want, but wanting what you have.
That's excellent. It speaks for itself.
It does. The next one's probably one of my favorites too, is forgetting gratitude. An attitude of gratitude is a prayer unto God. You may be looking negatively on your life, concentrating on problems that are still not totally corrected. Nobody wants to be a Pollyanna, but it's good to remember where you started from and how much better life is now. Gratitude is the key. I think all AA meetings are gratitude meetings. And I've looked in the scriptures. Keeping in your heart the Psalms, the Song of David, and religious songs in your heart, and in thanksgiving, an attitude of gratitude is a prayer unto God. Have that gratitude list. Remember how much you do have. Forget how much you think you don't have. It'll help.
And then something you mentioned last week, Joseph, is the point that gratitude is really action. If we're not taking action on the things we're grateful for and showing our gratitude in action, it's not real gratitude. And then we come full circle with the idea that working with others is the single most powerful thing we can do for our recovery. So we can work with others, we can show our gratitude, and they are a subtle reminder about how far we've come.
Yes, thank you. 15 is, it can't happen to me. You might not think, not me, not my body, not my friends, not my life. Think twice. This is thinking almost anything can happen to you, and it's more likely to if you get careless or complacent. Remember, you have a progressive disease, and you will be in worse shape if you relapse.
Absolutely. What do they call it? 10 feet tall and bulletproof?
Yeah. Omnipotent.
You need to be,
this is 16.
Taken down a couple notches. And we got 2 minutes.
I know. Omnipotence. The ego's on a binge. This is a feeling that results from a combination of many of the above. You have all the answers for yourself and others. No one can tell you anything. You ignore suggestions or advice from others. Relapse is probably imminent unless drastic changes take place.
Yes, indeed. We need to think about things we can learn from that.
I just read that?
Sure. It's been a pleasure.
I think it was... Harry S. Truman said, "When the time when you know it all, right after that is when you start to learn. After you know it all, that's when you start to learn." And that's what I have found. I think this was a help. I hope that there was an audience sufficient to listen to that. There's an archive. You can download the show if you go to rumradio.org. It's in Word. That means that anyone could copy all of it, any part of it, and use it whenever you need it, especially for sponsors when they need to get an idea what's going on with their sponsees. This is a big help for me. So I could see if I can see a relapse coming. Sometimes I can head it off with the pass. Sometimes I can't. I can't keep anybody sober. I can't keep anybody alive. If I think I can, I'm playing God. And it's hard enough playing sponsor. Thank you. See you on the radio, rumradio.org. Well, that's the end of the showtime. Showtime has ended, I believe. And I think we're on recording time now. So you have any last thoughts for the folks that are going to listen to this?
Well, I really appreciate the focus and the thread that runs through all of this, that we really need to remember where we've come from. There's no better way to do that than working with others, and we cannot work with others unless we have a sponsor and we have worked the steps. We cannot give away something we don't have. So that's the key. We need to get a pen and a paper and a person, a sponsor, and work those steps and continue, you know, step 10 we do on a daily basis. That's really the key. That's what helped me, and so I'm here to share my experience and what might strengthen and offer hope to others. And I know you are too.
Yeah, that was a lot of good information. We probably could have did a show on each one of those, just about, you know, just a lot of good information. I don't believe that there's such thing as too much good information. That's part of the problem with the Internet. There's a lot of good stuff. That's one side of the blade, and on the other side of the blade, there's a lot of bad stuff, too. People are inundated with information. People are always trying to capture your attention. There's so many people waving flags, it's hard to see which one would be pertinent and the ones that would be the most helpful. So hopefully the cream will rise to the top. I think this is a really good work. I've seen it work well in my life and other people's lives. Most of the sponsees I work with attain and maintain long-term sobriety. I'm nobody special by no means, although I have a systematic approach to the big book and God's in charge. But having tools is essential. If you've ever worked on a car or anything mechanical, you need the right tools. The right tools make the job go well. Well, that's it for me.
You can say that again. That is something that I experience on a daily basis. If you don't have the right tool, it makes everything take twice as long, and the outcome isn't satisfactory anyway. What's the story about the woodsman who said he doesn't have time to stop and sharpen his axe? But if he did, he could cut down 10 times as many trees. So we get blinded sometimes. One of the things that Oliver said stuck with me, and that's that it's a matter of changing perspective, changing perceptions. And then with recovery, our perceptions change. That's so vital to me.
Yes, and that's the key. Perceptions change. It's like with the marijuana deal. What a travesty. What a travesty that is. I can't believe people buy into that. It's just, it's amazing. People are going to, you know, in the argument.
They want their tax dollars.
Under any circumstance.
Yeah.
They got to have, it's all about the money, isn't it? It's all about the money.
Well, the fact remains there are more overdose deaths from alcohol overdose than all the other drugs combined.
Mm.
Alcohol is so destructive. And it's legal, it's available everywhere, and it's so destructive. They're proposing a new law. I think it went into effect on the 1st of September, and that is that you can receive a ticket and a 6-month automatic suspension of your license for driving with a blood alcohol level of 0.08. If you have a 1.5 blood alcohol level, it's automatically suspended for a year. And there's, what is it, a $10,000 fine or something.
Wow.
It was on the news. And I think that's a good idea. It's called being extremely drunk behind the wheel.
Oh, it's like the graduated fine for speeding. The faster you go, the higher the fine.
Yeah. And actually, one beer affects our driving. One beer affects our driving. So we can be impaired even though we're not 0.08 in our BAC.
Is there a tolerance level at all? Is it zero tolerance, or is it like 0.5 or 0.3, 0.1?
Well,
is there any tolerance?
If you're in a crash that involves a fatality, there's a zero tolerance. No alcohol is permitted whatsoever, or you're in for a felony. But driving, if it's below 0.08, you don't actually get a drunk driving ticket. And
how about the driving while impaired?
I think that's 0.08.
Oh, still, huh? Okay. Because I thought driving while under the influence.
Currently, the biggest problem, we're seeing the biggest increase in folks that are taking pain pills and driving. And a lot of people are getting hooked on hydrocodone and OxyContin. And,
they're very.
They don't have a blood alcohol level, but they will test positive for opioids, and that it's not legal to drive under the influence of pain pills either. So, and it says right on the bottle, do not operate heavy equipment. But a lot of people are impaired that way. In fact, I think Bill W. had a problem with pain pills.
I don't know that for a fact, but I wouldn't be surprised. A lot of it, I think, was because he had a depression and was treated for depression. But you got to remember, a severe alcoholic, alcohol is a depressant. And if you've been drinking long enough and then you stop drinking, I think that there's a brain chemistry that comes into play.
Oh yeah.
And I don't know for sure, but it just seems that way. And then how do we handle depression? We take pills.
Yeah, we take pills. Well, what I did was I felt depressed. I thought I should have a drink, not realizing that alcohol is a depressant, just makes it worse. But pills, and we branch out into all kinds of things. You know, a search for God at the wrong address.
Well, I like that. Yeah, Dr. J-U-N-G Young said that alcohol was a lower form of spirituality.
Yes.
Anyway, well, we've gotten a lot of information out, Harold. We can be proud of the information. Feel free, anybody who wants to use it, go to the website and print it out. Well, I ask
radio.org.
rumradio.org. All I ask you to do is pass it on.
There you go.
The credit for this work goes to God and the fellowship. So have a good evening. See you on the radio. Thanks again, Harold.
You're welcome. Thank you, Joseph.
Good night.
Good night.